Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I am Norma Walden, Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum. Our speaker today, Julia Geist, is a docent lecturer with the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, the De Young, and the Legion of Honor. Working with the Fine Arts Museum since 1979, she has been quite active as a docent for many shows, including the very popular Yves Saint Laurent exhibition at the De Young in 2008. She is now chair of the Docent Council of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Among other positions, she served as board president of the Museum of Craft and Folk Art in San Francisco. Please welcome Julia Geist.
Thank you all for having me here. And thank you very much for the step stool. I'm 5'1". It was a real pleasure to be a docent and to create a lecture about the Yves Saint Laurent exhibition that we had at the De Young at the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009. Did any of you all see it? Were you all, oh good, oh great, I'm really pleased. Then you're going to see a lot of familiar images and hear some familiar stories. But as you can see, Yves Saint Laurent had a very illustrious and a very long 40-year fashion career. And what my lecture does today, it certainly has to do in my mind with the ascent of women. But I also noticed as I was sitting here waiting for you all to enter how many skirts were being worn today. And so far I'm up to 5. And so I would like for you all to think in your minds, thank you, Yves Saint Laurent, for making it possible for all of us to wear pants in public, not just jeans, not just sweatpants to the store or whatever, but that we can be ladies in trousers. I begin with showing you Yves Saint Laurent looking at many, many sketches on the floor. It's the way he worked, and I will go into that at great length, and remind you that there were 129 pieces in the exhibition at the De Young, and I choose to call them, I and many of my docent friends and many of my people at, friends in the museum, to call them works of art. I'm here to talk about art, and I truly believe, and am one of the many in the cadre that believes, that fashion, creative fashion, haute couture, is art. So we begin with little Yves. Perhaps you all know that he's Algerian, and he was born in the summer of 1936. Here, the cute little baby boy, shown with his mother, Lucienne. As I was what I like to call reviving this lecture yesterday, because the last time I gave it was a year and a half ago, I discovered that his mother was at his funeral in the summer of 2008. And his mother was a housewife, took care of him and his two sisters, and his father was a businessman who also owned a lot of movie theaters. So they were well-to-do in their home of Algeria. And then we found that incredible little school photograph of Yves Saint Laurent. He was not happy in school. He didn't fit in really, really well in school, but he loved working with his sisters. The three children would work at creating stage sets and costumes for the sets and put on theater and plays, and so at a very, very early age. And at also a very early age, here's Yves Saint Laurent at the grand old age of 17, having been suggested that he enter the competition in Paris for the International Wool Secretariat. And you can see some of the kinds of designs he did. You can also see that he looks like a relatively mature 17-year-old. It looked a bit different in the 50s in Algeria and in France. And I'm delighted to tell you that he entered four competitions, and he won three first prizes. And his newfound, excuse me, his newfound buddy, Karl Lagerfeld, won the fourth. He was introduced at that time out of that competition to a man named Michel de Brunhoff, who immediately introduced him to Dior, who immediately hired him. Now, we're talking about a 17-year-old boy here. And he went to work for the House of Dior. So here you're seeing, again, him making designs for Dior in the 1950s. And I don't know if you all can see it well from where you are, but I can read it for you. This says, okay, on the upper left it says Christian Dior. Mr. Dior did not design that dress. Yves Saint Laurent did. And it is signed in the lower right, Y. Mathieu Saint Laurent. He comes to drop the Matthew and starts to be known as Yves. But within that, in that particular drawing, he's still Y. Mathieu. And you can see the drawings that he's making on the chalkboard to your right. And also, for Dior, Yves Saint Laurent creates these incredibly famous dresses. The one in the middle is unfortunately called the elephant dress, for obvious reasons. These models were posed at the Cirque d'Hiver, which was the winter circus in Paris. And these were done, as you all can see, in 1955. The model, by the way, in the lower middle is the famous woman Dovima, one of his favorite models. Well, at that time, or very soon thereafter, Dior unexpectedly died. He was on a trip in Italy, and he died. And there we have what happens to the House of Dior. And what happens to it is that Yves Saint Laurent is there to sort of make up the pieces. And I want to show you what he continues to work on, because they were working on the collection in 58 called the Trapeze Collection for the House of Dior. Yves Saint Laurent was working on it, Dior was working on it, and another designer named Marc Bohan was working on it. So on the left, you're seeing that collection. But on the right, you're seeing one of those trapeze dresses. And of course, what it is really unusual for the time and the place, because this is what Dior looked like. This is 1947. This is Le Bar. This is the new look that Carmela Snow from Harper's Bazaar said to Dior, oh, you're designing a new look, because it was after World War II and so on. So what that new look was the nipped-in waist, the beautiful padded shoulders, but soft, not big football ones like we get in the 80s, but the soft padded ones. And if you happen to be nice and thin, then you could patch your hips as well. So that is Le Bar on the left. So you can see how the trapeze really is a change. I also can tell you that for Dior, the garments are exceedingly structured inside. There's incredible construction work. And basically, the way I think of it is the woman refigures her body to fit the dress rather than the dress fitting or molding to the woman's figure. And you can see that Yves Saint Laurent is breaking away from that in the trapeze dress. The one on the right, by the way, does have a lot of undergarments and structure. It just doesn't look like it. Well, here is what happened as Dior dies. First of all, on the left, you're seeing Yves Saint Laurent in the house, working with models, working with clothes, and so on. But in 1958, when the balcony scene with the press below, it was a very big deal. Because, again, at the age of 19, quote-unquote, Saint Laurent has saved France. The great Dior tradition will continue. And we laugh at that, saving France, but it's not laughable, because the second largest industry in France at the time was haute couture, and Dior was the leading purveyor of it. So they had many, many people that worked for them, and this young man was in charge. And people think, oh, well, you know, you think of Pierre Berger, but he isn't on the scene yet, okay? Actually, Yves Saint Laurent did run the house at that very, very early age. But by 1960, he is starting something that we take for granted for Yves Saint Laurent, which is looking to the street, looking to youth for ideas for designs. And what happens at the House of Dior is that the people who, the businessmen, the investors, not to mention the clients, the elegant, rich ladies who shop at the House of Dior, don't like it. It's too youthful. It doesn't make them look dignified and elegant and stylish enough. And heaven forfend, by 1963, when we get into the beatnik stage, is that clientele going to be at all interested? So let me give you a little tiny bit about French history at the time. As I understand it, if you were a young man eligible for the military but were deemed by your industry as necessary, they didn't take you. They didn't draft you. You sort of, I like to teasingly say, you got a note from home. You know, you got a note from your boss saying you were absolutely irreplaceable and don't take him into the army. Well, guess what? The note from home didn't come in 1960. And so he indeed was drafted into the military. This is a man who's not particularly military-oriented and was certainly not suitable for the military. And as a consequence, he had a mental breakdown, and they put him in a mental institution. And within 2.5 months, they kicked him out of the military, which probably made him very happy. So he goes back to Paris, and he wants his job back, but he didn't get it back. Mark Bohan had stepped into his shoes. They were assuming he'd be gone into the military for a couple of years, and Mark Bohan was the kind of designer who pleased the clientele of the Dior, House of Dior, and also pleased the businessmen who were the money people in back of it. So he didn't get his job back. Meanwhile, he had met Pierre Berger in 1958, and when he came back out of the army, what Pierre Berger did is they sued the House of Dior because he didn't get his job back. And they won some money. And with that money, and I'm sorry I don't have the figures with me. If you really need it, call me and I'll find it for you. But anyway, they won some money. And with that money, they went to set up the House of Yves Saint Laurent. It wasn't quite enough money. And so Pierre Berger sought investors and found an American whose name was J. Mack Robinson from Atlanta. Anybody in this room heard of Robinson Department Stores in the South? It's that Robinson. And he invested, I believe it was $700,000 over 3 years, so that the House of Yves Saint Laurent opened in 1962 with garments such as these. This is another reason that I can defend fashion as art. I see these as classics. I would be happy to own and wear either one of them today, and they're over 40 years old. So think about that. And one of the other things I found fascinating about Yves Saint Laurent, he designed in black and white for a very long time before he introduced color into his collections. So 1962 begins the House of Yves Saint Laurent, and it lives for 40 years. He closed the house. Well, he didn't close it. He stepped out in 2002, and when I get to that decade, we'll talk about it more. But in 1962, he also founded his first scent, the first perfume. I'm sure you all know that haute couture and the fashion industry makes a lot of money on licensing, and one of the ways to do it is with perfumes, and you know that everybody has a perfume. He also had his first runway show in 62, but an interesting thing happened in his life in 62, and that was the end of the French-Algerian War. Remember, he's from Algeria, and his parents lived there. And the war was from 54 to 62. It was an eight-year-long, horrible war. And his family lost everything, and they came to Paris and sort of moved in on him. So his life is not real comfortable either. And also in 1964, he developed one of the first famous perfumes. It was called Y, or Y in French. And I have some on just for you tonight, and you can buy it at Jacqueline's if you would like. In 65, Charles of the Ritz brought out Robinson's share for a cool $1 million. And by 1966, Yves Saint Laurent opened Rive Gauche. And if you've been to Paris, you're familiar with it. It's on Rue Tournon, right across the plaza from Saint-Sulpice, the cathedral. So he is making it by the mid-60s. And then the other thing that I think about when I look at his clothes is all of the influences on him. And one of the very first in the mid-60s is very familiar to you, I'm sure. The Mondrian dresses, they're made out of wool jersey. No such thing as polyester, okay? Out of wool jersey. And they were very, very popular, and they were very... they were affordable vis-a-vis haute couture. For instance, at the time, one would cost about $1,800 if you bought it at the House of Yves Saint Laurent. If you bought it at I. Magnin's Custom Salon, I don't know if any of you all know that, with Henrietta Moon, you could get a reproduction for $795 or $800. And that was legal, and that's another lecture that I give. So just to remind you what Mondrians look like. And from Mondrian, we moved to Pop. Again, if those of you all saw the show, you'll notice these profiles are fabulous. They're part of the dress, and I'm particularly taken with the one on the left where the arm of the pink nude becomes the sleeve of the dress. Very sophisticated designs. And something that I hope you all are noticing is that the actual shape of the garment is very simple. Yves Saint Laurent is about the surface, be it the texture of the material itself, or the design upon the material. And just to remind you of what was going on, there's a Tom Wesselman pop art in the 60s, just to remind you what's going on in the cultures in the West and what he would be aware of. Yes, he knew Andy Warhol. He and Berger would come to New York and so on. So they were in the art society, in the art social world, along with Nan Kempner, which was an exhibition that we had just before, Nan Kempner, an American icon. Once she owned at least one, if not more, garments out of every single collection Yves Saint Laurent had, and that's for 40 years. And they were good buddies, as you can see in the picture on the left. I love to tell everybody she was 5'10", she weighed 110, she smoked. Unfortunately, she died of emphysema in 2006. And we were always asked what size was her dress. And I'm here to remind you that haute couture is not sized, because it is made to your body. You go to the house and you have the garment that you've picked. There can be more than one. You know, you can pick number 125, whatever that might be, and you and I can pick it. But it's made for my 5'1" body, don't I wish, and made for Nan Kempner's 5'10" body. So they're not sizes, but 110 pounds at 5'10". So what does he do? He makes at least 2,000 drawings per collection. And he has some ideas of swatches, which means the textiles that he thinks that would work with those designs. He did not design the fabric. He worked with really fine fabric houses, textile houses, but he didn't design the fabric himself. Before I continue with my sentence, what decade do you think we're in? The 60s. Doesn't it look like the 60s? Look at the skirts. Look at the hair. Look at the bow and the hair. So on and so forth. So what he would do is he would take these drawings into the studio where the seamstresses and the tailors and so on worked, and he had a couple of tailors that did work with him, and just lay them all out on the floor. And then his staff would walk around and look at them, and Jane Doe would say, "Oh, you know, I think I'd like to work on that one." Pick it up, take it back, and create it in the fabric that he suggested. And then they come back and they say, "Did it work or did it not work?" And the real test was, it works if it worked on a human body. If that dress, and maybe they'd have to change the fabric. Maybe, I mean, with 2,000 designs, you know, they threw away a lot of them. But that's how they worked. It had to work on a woman. And, of course, one of the main women that he loved to work with was Catherine Deneuve. If you all were reading about his funeral, you saw her there at the funeral. Very, very sad. And I did look up. This is trivia, but I can't stand it. You notice she carried a bundle of green wheat. I don't know if any of you all noticed that, but it was a big thing on all Twitter and blogs and stuff. It has to do with resurrection, because wheat, when you harvest it, the seeds, some fall to the ground and they're reborn the next year. So I just had to throw that in there. So here's Catherine Deneuve in a very 60s garment. I don't have a color photograph, but you know it's brown suede. How many of us owned one at the time, even if it wasn't an Yves Saint Laurent? And then, of course, the very famous movie Belle de Jour from 1966. And Yves Saint Laurent designed all of the clothing for that movie. I particularly like the image in the upper right. As you all know, she enjoyed her afternoons by being a prostitute. And so one of the outfits that she wore was like a little girl's uniform to seduce the men, the paying customers. And again, some of the designs for the movie on the left, some of the sketches. As I said, Catherine Deneuve was one of his muses. And one of the things that he learned early on in the 70s is that he wanted to empower women. This is a direct quote. "Fashion was not only supposed to make women beautiful, but to reassure them, to give them confidence, to allow them to come to terms with themselves." So he took his tux because he was very aware that, you know, whenever a man needs to dress up and go to a fundraiser or a ball or whatever, you put on your tux and you leave, right? Whereas we worry about what we're going to wear for 3 months in advance. He took his tux, he reconfigured it for women's body, and from there on out, he had a tux in every single collection. So maybe the lapels change, maybe the shoulders change, maybe the width of the legs change, but there was a tux for us, sometimes with a skirt, as you can see on Catherine Deneuve. This is a very famous pantsuit. This was Nan Kempner's, which she has given to the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. And this is that trivia story you may have heard in the De Young, where she shows up at a very upscale restaurant in New York City, and this is in the late 60s with this on, and the maitre d', who happened to be a woman, said, "You don't think you're going to come in here with pants on, do you?" And so she kind of looked at her, and Nan Kempner had a superb attitude. She bent down, stepped out of her pants, held them to her husband, Tommy, and said, "Tommy, hold these for me. I can't bend over." Mini skirts, right? And this is one 10 years later, again, a pantsuit, one that I would probably be very happy to have today, even though the shoulders are wide. It would work just fine. The reason it's white is that he had been listening to Porgy and Bess, and he was thinking about the American South and the white suits. You know, think of some of those wonderful stereotypical images with the hat and the black suit, shirt with the tie and the white suits and the black and white shoes and so on that the men wore, and he just picked it right up and gave it to us. And my very favorite tux photograph, in a photograph by Helmut Newton, on a rainy night in a narrow street in Paris. This very androgynous picture, isn't it? It's hard to tell whether it's a man or a woman. And ultimately, smoking, and the tuxes were called Le Smoking. 1984, this is an evening pantsuit also that he designed for his friend Betty Catrou, who was one of the social group in Paris at the time, one of his buddies. And you'll notice that this is where the logo YSL is coming from. That was put on there in rhinestones, and the suit itself is a blouson. It's very kind of full in the back, and a beautiful black velvet with embroidered rhinestones. And it was designed for him by a known designer, a known artist. And you may not know the name Cassandra, but you might very well know one of his posters from the 30s. Cassandra was a very famous Art Deco poster designer. He obviously was older when he designed the logo for YSL, but nevertheless, they too were friends. So we move into the 90s. You can see I'm on my tuxedo theme section. On the left is 1991, and on the right is Claudia Schiffer in 1996. I read that he wasn't real excited to have Claudia Schiffer as his model initially because he thought she was a bit too curvy. But he got over that, and she became a model for him for a long time after that. I also can tell you that Yves Saint Laurent was the very first couturier to hire women of color to be models. And this is a tuxedo from 2001, and it's black velvet with incredibly beautiful silk braid. I want you to see the details when you think about art. He, by the way, always gave credit to his seamstresses, to the people. I don't know their names. They weren't written down. But when he talked about them and so on, he always gave credit to the people who actually were the craftspeople. Black velvet. And in one version, not in this one, they're actually, it showed with knickers. And this is an homage to Oscar Wilde. As you can see, he takes his ideas and his influences from a lot of places, from artists, from writers, and in this case, he's now going to go to foreign countries. He was an armchair traveler. He didn't like to travel, but he knew where to find images. These are the famous African dresses, and by the way, I read these were evening dresses. 1967. The embroidery is very special. They're made out of raffia and wood and copper beads, all of whom get the credit of who did what as far as the creation of these. I'm showing you the mannequin on the left, which was in the exhibition. Those blue mannequins with the wigs were very, very famous. We were very lucky to be able to use them in the exhibition at the De Young. Those wigs were made by a very famous hairstylist, wig maker named Alexandre. And Alexandra did the wigs and the hair for all of Yves Saint Laurent's collections for 32 years. Alexander was a character himself. I understand he wore only white suits and he slept in a coffin. He sounds a little bit like Salvador Dali, doesn't he? And he also designed the wig for Elizabeth Taylor in Cleopatra. Remember, it's a very, very well-known wig maker. By the way, Dodie Rosecrans, I don't know if any of you all know, our local important women, one of her many jobs has been a former chair of the Board of Trustees of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, owned a dress very similar to the one on the right, and she has given it to our collection. Look familiar? Again, styles that don't go out of style. The safari jacket. So we go from African sort of tribal influences to the great white hunter within a year. The one on the left is one that was never made up except for this one American Vogue shoot, and it's worn by Verushka in 1968. Verushka made up her own life. She was an ordinary German person who ended up in this country as being Russian nobility, but that's a whole nother story. So again, what I'm showing you is several things. One is I consider it art. But number two, I'm running over our own history. If you happen to have lived during these decades, you know what we're talking about. And here's a very famous photo with a couple of his women friends, Betty Catrou, whom I mentioned earlier, and Lulu de la Falaise, who designed a lot of the jewelry for the house of Yves Saint Laurent. And, of course, there he is, and they're all very stylish in their safari outfits. This particular image is in the very end of the 60s. And also in the very end of the 60s, he started showing some nudity in a very subtle, ladylike way. And in the exhibition, the section was called The Body Revealed. And you can see what I mean by a very ladylike way. This is not Madonna. This is not Lady Gaga. This is the late 60s in which he's using a beautiful silk chiffon. It's just that we're not wearing anything under it. And if you need to, as you can see in the model on the runway in the lower center, you can pull your jacket on over it and so on. But I thought it was fun to see the design itself on your left. Penelope Tree in an Avedon photograph. She was a friend of the Beatles. You know, she was one of those society girls in the 60s, and then the actual runway and how it was, how they walked down the runway. I bet you, I don't know this, but I'm guessing that by the time you get to the end, you take the jacket off and drag it back down so that you get to see the whole thing. More body revealed. Do you see what I mean? But I say that they're transparent, but they're very ladylike. I was really interested to see in the exhibition the outfit on the left. There was a gold, very narrow belt. It was on the mannequin. It would have been on the woman's skin, not on the outside of the dress. And then you got the wonderful feathers for a modesty on the left, and then the feathers and the silk chiffon on the right. Late 60s, early 70s. Also in the late 60s, I've always forgotten, this is my favorite one. This is called waist sculpture. I prefer to call it bust sculpture. And these are actual molds made in plaster on a woman's breasts. And then the copper, the very thin, malleable copper sheet can be pressed into the plaster mold so that you get the perfect shape. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't squeeze. It's made for the person who's going to wear it. And they were created by a jewelry-making couple who, again, friends of Yves Saint Laurent named Claude Lalanne and his wife, Francois Javier Lalanne, who just happened to be having an exhibition in Paris at the Decorative Arts Museum as we speak. So, and they also did some decorations for his apartment. So he really associates with other artists and uses them and works with them. And more transparent garments. Now, these are the late 60s, the early 70s, and at the same time as we're showing the body, we're revealing the body, very elegantly, very beautiful bodies, we're also covering them. Oh, I always forget that's in here. Let me back up. Showing the bodies and so on, it's not all transparent clothes. This, of course, is a reference to Jean Cocteau, the filmmaker. Perhaps you saw the old classic film Beauty and the Beast. And it's silk satin with gold embroidery and beautiful black satin embroidery, referring to a poem that Jean Cocteau wrote. And if you really would like to hear the poem, I can't read it, but I've got it with me if you'd like to read it. that what I was leading up to is we go from transparency to covering everything up in the same time frame, 69-70, with the maxi coats. The one on the left in black and white is actually a green Loden coat, a beautiful, big, almost military-looking one. And the one on the right is velvet. It's panels that look a little bit like quilt, but they're really patchwork. They're not quilted at all. And I was told, but they never let us see it, that for each rectangle in that coat is lined with a different colored of gray silk inside. So there would be modulations of gray on the inside, and of course the silk would feel very, very good. The hat was lent to the exhibition by Yves Saint Laurent. That is his hat for us to show. This one on the right is out of the exhibition in 1989, which was called The New Look to Now, in the Old to Young. 1971 was quite a watershed year for Yves Saint Laurent. He had quite a variety of things in his collection. And again, notice how the shape of this, and it is a coat, a suit, notice that the shape is very classic, very simple, what I call a back, a front, and two sleeves and a skirt. No, and I'm not ridiculing them. I think they're magnificent. And then what he does is he does something outrageous on the surface texture, which is appliquing silk satin red lips all over it. So it would take quite a confident woman to wear something like this. But 71 was quite a year for Yves Saint Laurent because he went from the maxi coats to the fox chubs. This is dyed green fox fur. The one on the right is similar to the one that Dodie Rosecrans gave to the De Young. We own that. But it was horrifying to the public. You notice Naomi Campbell doesn't look like she has anything on under it. And so that was a shock in 1971. Another thing that happened with the collection in 1971 is that the French public were kind of outraged. Because what he's doing is, number one, he had seen, Paloma Picasso in some vintage clothing, and he loved it. So he went back. This is stuff looking like the 40s, right? And that offended many of the French buyers because they didn't want to go back to the 40s. That was not a great time in the French life in the 40s and World War II. And they also made a very interesting connection is that if women in the 40s could have afforded clothes like this, they undoubtedly had to be collaborators. And so it was a really ugly period. And in fact, Time magazine called it the Yves Saint debacle. It was a bust. Nobody liked it, including this gorgeous, gorgeous dress, which of course reminds all of us of that very famous Man Ray photograph of the woman looking like a stringed instrument in the back, which women do that who have nice bodies. So a beautiful, beautiful garment was denigrated. Of course, now everybody thinks it's terrific. But in 1971, it was a bust. And it wore him out, this collection. He was exhausted, and basically he started pulling back. He started not being seen in public so much. And what really did him in, forgive my language, is that he introduced his first perfume for men called Lum and posed for it. But after a couple of years, he did come back and design clothes that you and I would deem a little bit more wearable, certainly day wear. This is an outfit from Nan Kempner's collection. Again, swatches and designs. Can you all see the designs on the bottom? Does that remind you? Do you know that collection? 76. It's the Russian, the really opulent, elegant, incredible fabrics, incredibly beautiful clothing. Well, here's the sketches and some of the designs. Again, throw them out on the floor in the studio. Let people, the workers, the wonderful craftswomen, pick them up and go to work. And here's some of the results. Incredible results. These Russian dresses could cost anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 in 1976. Okay, so very, very expensive. And one of the pieces of trivia I picked up when the Yves Saint Laurent show was here and Hamish Bowles gave a lecture was that there is at least one woman in the United States a couple of years ago whose budget for clothing was $360,000. So a $10,000 to $30,000 dress was a fraction of the budget. And in that same time, he was influenced by the Chinese created the Chinese collection, and you can see that he's working on the idea of a Cheongsam over the loose trousers. And on the right, that actually became a symbol for the perfume produced that year called opium. I don't know if you all remember opium. Well, that was a fussed over also because people got all anxious about drugs. You know, oh, it's about opium, and they had a big, the big marketing ploy was on a Chinese junk in the New York River and so on and so forth. So that went bust also. So really, it really does have to do with timing, doesn't it? As I said, he was an armchair traveler, and he loved Spanish, beautiful flamenco dresses and so on. So here is the influences from the late 70s out of Spain. The one on the right, the sketch, those pink, that one was in the exhibition, and it looks like two matador capes hanging one on the shoulder and one below the hips. And back to artists. He's always influenced by artists, and Picasso, of course, would be a good one to be influenced by. I want you to look at the work on this. This is silk appliqué. Yves Saint Laurent was not sewing these. He had an incredible group of women who would do the work for him. So unbelievable craftsmanship. This is a work of art, right? I don't think any of you all would disagree with me on that. And Picasso again on the front here. And I just threw in a profile of Marie-Thérèse Walter, one of Picasso's mistresses from the 30s, just to show you the profile and remind you all where Picasso is looking. And then Matisse, those beautiful cutouts that Matisse did at the end of his life, although the one I found was 1953, and he lived a lot longer than that, but at least those wonderful cutouts. And then perhaps you all know, and I will end when I end, with the auction, that he owned this fabulous Matisse. And so you see him here in his apartment, and then you see a dress, and I did find one that I thought was referential for the dress and Matisse in the early 80s. That is a navy silk taffeta evening gown. But I like to come back to clothes that you can wear, that you're not just going to great balls and fundraisers and evening events, to show you the 15-year span of coats. And again, for me, and I know I keep putting myself in this, but I see the smiles out there. I think all of us would wear any one of these coats today, and yet it would be 15 years old. The youngest would be 15 years old, and so they don't go out of style. The one on the left is cashmere. Nice and warm for Paris. It gets really cold in Paris in the winter. And in 1980, Berger signed the 190th YSL license. You all know what that means. They license luggage, they license sheets, they license perfume, and so on. Yves Saint Laurent finally got so fed up with all of it that he had Berger buy back a lot of the licenses because he didn't like his name on everything in sight that wasn't his, you know, that he didn't design. And in the 80s, I'm sure these look familiar to us who live and work in San Francisco, especially the double-breasted pinstripe dress on the right, which is made from men's suiting. Men's suiting, of course, is for comforts. It lasts a long time. It costs money, but if you know the men in San Francisco, especially of a certain age, they'll wear it for 30 years if they stay the same size. So they're for very powerful women, business women, and so on. Also in 1982-83 for that collection, it was his 20th anniversary. Remember, he started in 62. And Diana Vreeland, the maven of fashion in the United States, presented him with an award for the Council of Fashion Designers in America. He's really making it. He's making a lot of money. He's got recognition. He's got the licenses and so on. But he keeps designing. He doesn't just rest on his laurels, as we say. So these are some of his suits from the 80s. And some sketches for the suits in the 80s. You'll notice the swatches are black. If we could see them, I'm sure they would be really nice wool that would, you know, nice cashmere or something mixed with, you know, vicuña or something, really fine fabric. But he also is designing evening dresses that aren't flamboyant, that aren't marketing people as you did. Say something about fashion being art, and how does it go with the big fashion shows today with things that look so outrageous and so unwearable? And I have two answers. My favorite answer is money. Anytime I don't know the answer to a question, the answer is money. But the real reason, I think, is marketing. Those fashion shows are created for marketing, and they don't expect you to wear some of the outrageous things. They're just there to get the name out there. But Nan Kempner certainly wore these and enjoyed them very much. And in 1983, the Metropolitan Museum gave an exhibition to a living fashion designer. Was the first one ever. And here comes Nan Kempner entering in her Yves Saint Laurent, which was made for the opening and for her. 1 million people saw that show in New York City, and it traveled to Beijing, to Paris, to Sydney, and St. Petersburg. It was a big deal, the first ever for a living designer, and that designer was our hero, Yves Saint Laurent. He also, by the way, was made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor that year as well. So he's definitely made it. Back to artist influences. Before I show you the influence, you know who it is, don't you? Sure you do. And a little plug for the De Young Museum. In September, we will open the Orsay II exhibition of the Post-Impressionists, and you're going to get to feast on Van Goghs and Gauguins and Toulouse-Lautrecs and Cezannes and company. Now, these are unbelievable examples of workmanship. The embroidery on these, you can't do that. It can't be done. And I do have the prices on this somewhere. Yes, in 1988, each suit would cost $100,000. In today's money, that's $176,000. But remember the lady whose budget is $360,000, so she could blow half her budget on this. George Braque, actually, he and Picasso called themselves married, and I don't mean any sexual connotations about that. It's just because they painted so much alike before World War I in the 1905, 6, 7 time that they got to the point where they didn't know whose painting was whose. So, of course, if Yves Saint Laurent is looking to Picasso for influence, he's also looking at Georges Braque, another Braque. And then back to everyday wear, just so we don't lose sight of the fact that he's continuing to do that as well. This is beige raw silk. This is 1989, and this is where the gossip columnists really start to go crazy. There's speculation that his bad health is due to AIDS. There has never been any proof that the man had AIDS, okay? Never. And he was the very first fashion house to be quoted on the stock market. So 1989. And this was the evening gown that he designed for Nan Kempner to go to Malcolm Forbes' 70th birthday. And this helps me remind us that we're really looking at color now. The color gradations in this ensemble are fabulous, from the blues to the greens to the olive greens. And, of course, you can see that it's a silk chiffon, so you can see through it, and you're going to get different colors, different gradations of blues and greens as Nan Kempner or whoever buys it moves. It's going to be a palette of colors, a moving palette of color. And he, of course, is interested in saris, like we all are, because we live across the bay from Berkeley. The one on the left, I couldn't find a picture of it. It is gold lamé, and it is the top and the bottom are connected with one long zipper from under the arm down to the hip. And I can't, anyway, look on your right. From under her arm, down across that hip, there was one long zipper. Again, the craftsmanship is unbelievable. And then it's Yves Saint Laurent who dares to put yellow and lavender and magenta and hot green together and make it work. Perhaps you all know that he and Pierre Berger had homes in Morocco starting in the late 60s. They had three. He was very much influenced by Morocco. He loved it. It was a nice place to relax, to rest. And I'm sure that his creative ideas are percolating in there while he's resting. And so one of the things that influenced him, of course, were the tribal garments, those wonderful desert browns, deep browns, and rusts. This particular one is a homespun cape, and it's a crepe dress. It was so popular that Lauren Bacall, Catherine Deneuve, and Nan Kempner all bought one. And by the way, that's something for me to tell you. You and I, if we were so lucky, could own the same outfit, the same design. So they're not unique. but they are haute couture because you've gone to the house and you've had it fitted to you and you buy it from there. You didn't buy it off the rack. These wonderful garments that you see in Chanel or Rive Gauche and stuff is ready to wear. It's not haute couture. There he is, resting. And here's one of his last houses, the one he bought in 1980, just to show you the color that he's surrounded by and where that, how he applies that to his designs. In 1980, they bought this 1920s house in Marrakesh, and it's near a special gardens called the Majorelle Gardens. And when he dies, they take his ashes back to Marrakesh and scatter his ashes in that garden. And on your right, again, Arab, Marrakesh, Morocco-inspired garment. You can see the breasts peeking through. He's sort of combining a bunch of things. You can also see the beading, which is probably referring back to the African dresses. But he also has the harem pants as well. And so he's not only being influenced by Morocco, but he's being influenced by Léon Bakst, who was the designer for the Ballet Russe, who came to Paris and took Paris by storm in right before World War I. Excuse me, let me go back for a minute. Oh, never mind. So while you look at those, I wanted to catch you up on his life a little bit. We're in 1991 on the right, and YSL, Yves Saint Laurent, publicly disclosed his drug addiction, and he also disclosed his homosexuality. So that was a big to-do in the presses. By 1993, Elf, which is the petroleum company in France, bought Yves Saint Laurent out for $650 million in shares. And the collection was dedicated to Nureyev, who had just died of AIDS. You all know the ballet dancer Nureyev. They also, in 1993, produced yet another perfume, and they called it Champagne. Can you guess what happened to champagne? Have you ever heard of it? No. There's a good reason. Because the champagne industry sued them over the name. And Yves Saint Laurent lost. So in 1994, it turned out that Ralph Lauren, in designing a tuxedo, got a little too close to Yves Saint Laurent designs. So Berger sued Ralph Lauren and won. There's the trivia for the 90s for you. And then, just to remind us all, in 1996, he's still looking at these very simple, classic designs, very, very wearable, desirable. And I just thought I'd point out to you, 32 years earlier, he was doing that as well. So his vision is really pure. Does that make sense? He does have a vision, and what he works with is the materials, the decorations, the embroidery, the lace, the feathers, the whatever, but the basic shape, front, back, and sleeves, really stays stable. Now, he said, all the way back from when he was a little kid designing theater stage sets and costumes and stuff with his sisters, that if he hadn't been a fashion designer, he would have been a theater designer. And he did do a lot of theater and ballet designs, especially for Zizi Jeanmaire, and that would have been in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He actually designed five ballets for Roland Petit, who Jeanmaire was dancing for. He did five for her. And all told, he did designs for 23 theater productions and 9 movies. And you've probably all seen one of them, and that is the La Belle de Jour for Catherine Deneuve. But he also did three for her. He did one for Claudia Cardinale, which you've probably seen, the Pink Panther. And he did several for Sophia Loren. So that's sort of his hidden life that we don't think about very much and probably would have been his life if it hadn't had that wonderful miracle happening of being introduced to Dior when he was 17 and his life going off into the fashion business. This is designed for Zizi Jeanmaire. Can you see her? Her legs were probably as long as I am tall. You know, just incredible. She started out as a ballet dancer and moved into more stage and musical dancing. And here's the basic shape that I keep talking about. However, the one on the left is a leopard print, which is all embroidery. And the one on the right looks like fish scales. They're just beautiful, glowing objects. And another quote by Yves Saint Laurent, "I look for opposites, the unexpected unexpected, but only in materials. The style never changes. And one of the more shocking ones is this incredible cape. Did you all know what the feathers are here? They're rooster tails. Think how beautiful rooster tails are, that beautiful shimmering greeny black. And he made a whole cape out of it. And then, of course, the hit of the show is the one on the left. And it was surprising to me to learn, I'm not surprised that it was pheasant feathers, but it also includes vulture feathers. Each feather was taken, stripped by hand, so only the end of it is left, and then they are sewn one by one onto a muslin basic dress, which was made by somebody else, Abraham and Bianchini. So the basic dress is just like you'd expect a Yves Saint Laurent to be, and then every single pheasant and vulture feather is sewn on. And by the way, it didn't quite look like this in the show, because what the model has done is she's worn this big coat out, and as she's turned around, as they do, she's taken it off and she's dragging it behind her. So that's where you see this big, beautiful display of feathers. Fall-winter 2000. In 1999, Yves Saint Laurent was bought out by the Gucci Group, and Tom Ford started designing the ready-to-wear, like the Rive Gauche, but Yves Saint Laurent kept designing the haute couture, and you can see this incredible color that Yves Saint Laurent continues to use. When we talk about paintings, we call an artist a colorist. Yves Saint Laurent is a colorist. In 2000, this collection, Berger sold the company to Gucci, but the rights to the label alone netted Berger and Saint Laurent over $250 million. Perhaps you all know that all collections end with a wedding dress, so I thought I would bring these in. This is a much more quote-unquote normal wedding dress, but this is one from 1965. This is wool knit, and we all had the opportunity in the show to get pretty close to it and just look at the knitting, the verb to knit. The creation of this was unbelievable. And, of course, we're all making really unkind remarks about what it reminds us of and so on. So I had to find out what indeed was the influence, and you'll be surprised. So bring your mind elsewhere. As we move to 1971, because he designed the wedding outfit for Bianca Jagger, and you'll notice the design for another wedding outfit shows this huge red heart to sub for the engagement ring. I've read that he's quite a romantic guy. He really was a gentle, romantic man, and you'll see that over and over again. And you'll notice that here there's this big heart. In the real heart, there were reproductions for sale in the museum, but the real heart is diamonds and rubies. And he had it on a model for every collection. And I don't know when that began, but once it began for every collection, he had a model wear it. And the reasoning by him was that was the favorite outfit in the collection that she was wearing. However, there might be a secondary reason, and that was if the girl was having trouble, like if she was not feeling well or if she'd broken up with her boyfriend or something, she got to wear it too. So he really is a nice romantic guy. Here's the very last. This was a retrospective. It was the collection for the 40th year. There's Claudia Schiffer in the wedding dress. There was a big retirement celebration. It was so huge. It was held at the Pompidou Center, which you all know is the big modern museum in Paris. So he went out on a very high note, 40 years of incredible designing and so on. But by that year, 2002, he was in pretty poor health. He was pretty depressed. Alcohol was moving in on him. So as he closed, his brand, as you all know, survives. In this case, I'll show you a couple of examples because they're ready to wear. It's Tom Ford on the left. By 2004, Ford left, and the designer today is Stefano Pilati. But these are under the brand name of Yves Saint Laurent, but you all know he died, so he can't possibly still be designing them, but the names continue. With purses and perfume, there's that Y, the Y at the top. Incredible shoes, I'm a shoe person. One of the quotes I love about the purses is that he hated handbags hanging down from women's hands. He wanted them to be bandolier style, so he designed them. So I bet you money he didn't design those purses. And I thought it would be fun for you to get a reprise of some of the ones that you have seen tonight and think about which one you really covet. And then I suspect you all know he died a summer 2 years ago. He died of a brain tumor. As I said, there's never been any proof the man had AIDS. And after that, there was planned this big auction. And Pierre Bergeau planned the auction, and there were 700 pieces in it. You can Google it and see every single one of them. And his quote was, "Yves Saint Laurent is dead. The collection doesn't mean anything anymore because it belonged to the two of them and their thinking, their collecting, their aesthetic. And so the individual objects didn't mean anything." Well, they speculated that it would bring $200 to $300 million. It brought over $484 million. And it included, I love some of the things it included, Picasso, Matisse, Renaissance jewelry, manuscripts of the works of French authors. Remember that Cocteau piece? Gustave Flaubert and André Gide. It included drawings by Picasso, Goya, Matisse, Mondrian, Art Deco pieces, sculptures, and antique furniture. I think I have a picture of this. Yes, I do. These are some of the pieces that sold. The Matisse made an all-time record purchase price of $46.4 million for a Matisse. And that incredible chair called the Dragon Chair in the center bottom by the Art Deco designer, a great designer named Eileen Gray in the 30s, was estimated for about $2 to $3 million. It sold for $28.3 million. It sold for 10 times the estimate. So the proceeds do go to a charity set up by Berger, and it benefits the Berger Yves Saint Laurent Foundation. And what they're trying to do right now, and have been, is collect an example of every single work that he created. Nan Kempner's estate, she died in 2006. Nan Kempner's estate has donated 90 of her pieces, and they're very excited to get some because they didn't have all of them. And the remainder was set up for scientific research to fight against AIDS. And these decisions were made with Yves Saint Laurent while he was still alive. So I would like to conclude by hoping that you all love him as much as I do. And a final quote: "The most beautiful clothes that can dress a woman are the arms of the man she loves. But for those who haven't the fortune of finding this happiness, I am there."
Our enthusiastic thanks to Julia Geist, docent lecturer of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. We didn't really allow much time for questions, not wanting to cut this wonderful lecture, but she has kindly agreed to take a couple. We have a mic here on Ellis. We'll pass it out for a couple of questions, and then we will have to say goodnight.
We're on?
Yeah.
We're on?
Yes. Had a quick question. I noticed in the reprise, 1964, 1994, a lot of the lines that he was doing reminded me of Coco Chanel.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any
I do. Thank you for reminding me. He really saw her as a muse. And again, I think I mentioned it to you all, or did it? Was I just chatting? Last week I gave a talk called The Art of French Fashion, From the New Look to Now, and the Legion of Honor. And you will see Coco Chanel's pantsuits done in the 30s being worn by Marlene Dietrich. And Yves Saint Laurent certainly paid homage to Chanel.
Any questions?
Anybody else?
Okay.
Well, thank you all very much.
Thanks.